Welcome to the ASHP Advantage Podcast, engaging the experts on ASHP Official, featuring conversations with top-level practitioners about the latest issues in pharmacy and healthcare.
Thanks for joining us in this episode of Pharmacy Hot Topics, where we sit down with content matter experts and discuss what is currently top of mind in the world of pharmacy. My name is Mike Gagneau. I'm Senior Director of Pharmacy Practice and Quality at ASHP, and I'm joined by our experts today, Kathy Yang, who is Co-Vice Dean, Clinical Innovation and Entrepreneurship, and Professor at UCSF School of Pharmacy and Infectious Diseases Clinical Pharmacist at UCSF Medical Center, Sarah Parsons, Clinical Pharmacy Specialist, Pediatric Infectious Diseases and Antimicrobial Stewardship Co-Lead at the Children's Hospital of the King's Daughter in Norfolk, Virginia, and Monica Mahoney, Clinical Pharmacy Specialist, Infectious Diseases at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, Massachusetts. Thanks for joining me today. Today's episode is part of the ASHP Advantage podcast series, Engaging the Experts, featuring conversations with top-level practitioners. And this episode is sponsored by AstraZeneca and is for informational purposes and not approved for continuing education credit. Let's get started talking about today's topic of COVID-19 news and updates. So let's, with our standard format, we typically turn to Kathy for updates on COVID, hospitalizations, variants, et cetera. Kathy, what can you tell us?
Thanks, Mike. So lots of good news. So we are approaching the lowest point that we've had in terms of test positivity in COVID in the US since this all started. The lowest we've ever been, it was actually June of last year, but that was in the summer, and we're getting almost to that point. So ED visits are down, indicators for hospitalization and deaths are down. So we're looking like we're in good shape there. I think the thing that we could talk about is probably the fact that even though, you know, everyone, all the COVID is going down now, it's no longer top of mind as that we've been talking about. But it's really important still that we still get people who need to be vaccinated. And, you know, that's pretty much slowed down, I think, in the US. We don't think about it as much. We don't think about it as much for our immunocompromised patients as much. So really making sure our patients who are at risk get their booster shots and are up to date on their vaccines. Sarah, what does it look like for the peds?
Pediatric perspective, I think the biggest barrier is that we're still under the influence, or most of the nation is under the influence, that our pediatric patients don't get sick and they don't get COVID and they don't have complications. However, if children have an underlying medical condition, they are at increased risk for severe infection. Although children without underlying conditions as well can have complications. We do know that patients that have genetic, neurological, and metabolic complications, congenital heart disease, are all at risk for potentially severe risk infections. And also similar to adults, children that have obesity, diabetes, asthma, chronic lung disease, sickle cell disease, and have immunocompromise are also at increased risk. So it is something that we still need to consider. Unfortunately, based off data from March 30th, 2024, about 14% of children are actually up to date with their 2023-2024 COVID vaccination rates. And only about 8% of children have a parent that have reported they definitely plan to vaccinate their child against COVID-19. So there's certainly a deficit in use of what we should be doing, but I think that that is probably multifactorial, and that's something that as pharmacists, we play a role to really be able to help facilitate increasing those vaccination rates through education. So hopefully that will continue to improve. One of the things that there was an article published in Pediatrics in April 2024 that actually showed that there is, as far as, you know, children do get long COVID or post COVID sequela syndrome, or PASC, I think it's abbreviated, depending, it's the same thing essentially, depending on where you see it. But this publication actually looked at a large cohort of children and showed that there is a decrease in patients that have complications, even if they do become infected with long COVID or this post sequela after getting vaccinated. So hopefully we can utilize that as a stepping stone to get more children vaccinated as well.
Great. And speaking of the vaccines, any updates on formulation or schedule or anything our listeners might want to know?
Not yet. It's still kind of in the same boat. We do have FDA approval for the mRNA vaccines for children greater than 12 years of age, and it's still through EUA for 6 months through 11 years. I think, oddly, that has still led to some apprehension as well. And then, of course, the Norovax is only approved for children greater than 12 years of age. And depending on the age of your child, whether you're going between age 4, age 5, age 6, which becomes a confusing area, and whether or not your child is considered to be immunocompromised, the number of vaccines, and depending on which one of the brands you utilize, are all variable. And for the sake of boredom, I will not go through all of those with everyone today. But, you know, practice the same way that I do. I look at the chart every single time because it's just, it's impossible for me to memorize those. And I'm too afraid I'm going to mess them up because they are variable. So I just really advise everybody to kind of look at those charts that are available in the CDC resources to evaluate exactly what we should be doing each time.
Kathy, any adult news on vaccines?
Not really. I think we've been pretty much status quo. Those guidelines haven't changed since the 2023-24 vaccine came out. And similar to what Sarah said, you know, the vaccine rates for adults, she mentioned 14% for kids. It's about 23% for adults overall have received a 2023-24 vaccine. It does go up with age, which is the good thing, and within immune compromised patients, but it's still not where we should be. So it's just something that we always have to keep top of mind. You have a patient that gets admitted, scan to see what their vaccine schedule looks like. Are they up to date? And really make sure to target, again, those populations that are either more vaccine hesitant or less trusting of the medical system, or the ones that don't have access. So we have to always remember that we have to keep our patients who are most at risk, due to the health disparities, at our top of mind to make sure they're the ones that get vaccinated because they are the most at risk.
Great, thanks. And new since our last discussion, or at least our last podcast, as far as prevention, there's a new pre-exposure prophylaxis medication. We jokingly refer to it as PEMIVA. What? but it's so back in. Many of our listeners may or may not know, I guess, nomenclature for monoclonals is changing. There was some changes a couple years ago. And so even though pemivibart sounds like it's not a monoclonal by our conventional nomenclature, it is a monoclonal. But what do we know about pemivibart? So we have an EUA that was issued, in March? So it's still new. But any news or any information to share, experiences yet?
Yeah, so I'll start and then I'm going to punt it to the peds world. This is called PEMGARDA. It's made by Invivid. The generic name, of course, is PEMIVIBART. The BART makes us, of course, all think of Bart Simpson jokes. This was EUA authorized in March 22nd of this year for PrEP. So it's got essentially the same indication that tixagivimab, so gevimab, which was Evusheld made by AstraZeneca, had. So it's the pre-exposure prophylaxis for patients 12 and older who are moderately to severely immune compromised and do not, and these are patients you would not expect to be able to mount an immune response to vaccine. So it is now commercially available. The main difference between this drug and tixagivimab, so gavimab, which was deauthorized last year, is it is not free. So it is commercially available. We do have to pay for it. It is available through McKesson. It's not cheap, though. It's about $5,775 per dose, and it does require a repeat dose at 3 months. So that's sort of the pricing part of it. It was FDA authorized based on this new immunobridging study design, which is how our vaccines are actually FDA authorized. So essentially, there is no clinical outcome data for this drug, but efficacy is assumed based on virus neutralizing antibody ability. So essentially, what they do is they take an anchor trial, which in this case was adintrevimab. It was the EVADE study. It was like the parent drug. And they looked at basically clinical outcomes based on that study, which were through very minimal because, you know, these studies are hard to do because variants are sort of rolling the whole time you're doing these studies, and it's really hard to sort of catch up. But they developed, basically, they defined a standard neutralizing antibody level based on that study and applied it to pemivibart. So that is what the FDA authorization is based on. So the study for this is called Canopy, which is the actual prep study for this. The data for that has not yet been released, but we'll hopefully see that soon. So that is sort of the clinical background part of this study, how it got to where we are. The main thing that is going to be difficult about this study is actually, it is an IV infusion. So it does have to be given over an hour. And in the clinical trial for Canopy, it did have a fairly high hypersensitivity infusion reaction rate of 9% and anaphylaxis in 0.6% in both the first and second dose. So both the first dose and the repeat dose. So because of that, this drug actually ended up with a box warning of hypersensitivity and anaphylaxis. So that's something to be aware of. And it does then require a 2-hour sort of post-infusion observation period. So that's sort of the background on the study. We have been trying to implement this drug, and so we're working on getting it together. And I'd love to hear now from Sarah how they're going to use this in the peds, and what are you going to do about this whole hypersensitivity and anaphylaxis piece?
So one of the, of course, the most important thing here is when you talk about the Canopy study is, you know, this is approved for adolescents age 12 and older and greater than 40 kilos. It's both of those, not one or the other. And the reason for that is if you were to do a little extra digging, and this has happened, and you know, I don't fault parents for this at all when there's a new therapy that we're recommending for their child. And if they go to study that and they look at what that's based on, you're going to see that it wasn't studied within this population. And that can certainly cause a lot of apprehension. And I get a lot of questions about that. And the important thing about explaining this to families or the patient, if they see that, is that this is extrapolated, which I have in pediatrics, if you utilize the word extrapolate to adults, everybody cringes and they stare at you and they judge you. But this is one scenario where it's appropriate to extrapolate those results to this population because they do have very similar body habitus, similar weights. Patients with these weights were included in the studies with greater than 40 kilos. Also, patients 12 years and older, they have the same you know, hepatic metabolism, renal function, et cetera, with this patient population. So it is appropriate to extrapolate that. I don't have any apprehensions. So as far as implementing in the world of pediatrics, this is probably the only time I would say that this would be a benefit because we had a very difficult time with texagevimab is the fact that it was intramuscular. And so we're getting our patients to stay up to date with these COVID vaccinations and really, you know, pushing that, and that is their priority. And this is an additive because they still have to have both. And so we're trying to get our patients to get these, you know, vaccinations, not only their children. So not only are they getting their COVID-19 vaccine, also going to be getting, you know, these therapies. And it ends up being like 4 or 5 injections at a time. And kids don't like needles. So it didn't go well. And the uptake was very poor. Oddly, with the IV infusion, a lot of the patients, and certainly not all, but a lot of the patients who would qualify for this are going to already have IV access, especially our hematology oncology patients, some of our transplant patients may already have access. So it may be easier to give this and maybe utilized more. It certainly is going to be difficult from an administration standpoint because we're going to have to utilize our outpatient infusion centers to do this and or our transplant clinics or hematology oncology clinics because it is, you know, an hour long infusion and they do have to sit there and wait for 2 hours thereafter. It is important that they are in a facility where they could have an emergency response initiated should they have this type of reaction. That's also a very important thing to counsel our patients and families on is that it is a risk. And unlike so many other things, it's a risk at any of the doses that you would receive. So it's not just with the initial. The other thing that I think is going to cause a lot, it's causing certainly a lot of headaches and difficulty is the cost and insurance coverage and guaranteed insurance coverage and what's the reimbursement going to be? And the patients are going to ask, well, what am I going to be responsible for? And that's very variable depending on their insurance and depending on what that's going to be. So if they're going to ask, what am I going to have to pay? It's a very hard thing to accurately tell them, as it is with many things in medical care. But, you don't want to tell them, oh, this is how much it's going to be, and then they get slapped with a $20,000 bill. So it's certainly, there's a lot of moving factors and things that we need to work out and knowledge that we need to gain before, this is fluid and easy. But I think that there's a lot of minds working together to try to help us get there. And I think it's a huge basis for education and explaining why it's important and being just open about what those barriers are and what some of the complications are.
You know, the funny thing, Sarah, is we talked about this before. For you guys, for the peds world, having it be an IV infusion is like a plus because kids don't want to be stuck. And for us in the adult world, hearing that it's IV infusion, we're going, oh, God, it's now a 4-hour infusion clinic visit when the IM tizagivimab was basically a drive-through clinic for us, in and out, and you're done in half an hour. So it's interesting that for us, it's a barrier, but for you, it's a plus. And I totally agree that the cost issue is going to be a big thing. It is supposed to be covered by Medicare for both reimbursement to the facility and for the drug cost because it's no longer free. But I think it will be really interesting to see what happens with private insurance. Of course, we're going to have to do prior authorization. We need to figure that out before we implement so we don't accidentally surprise any of our patients with a huge cost at the end.
I just started pulling you over to Pete's. I love it. Parents. yeah, I think that that's definitely something to consider. And it certainly is no walk in the park getting IV access on a child either. But I think that we'll at least be able to capture the population that already have ports and things like that. But, the problem also with tixagivimab was it was multiple injections, especially in some of our kids that have, smaller muscle mass. You maybe be able to get by with it's one IM injection, but when you're saying it's three or four or whatever, it doesn't go well. And so I think some of them would actually probably rather have, and I actually had a patient ask me that specifically, an adolescent boy, can I just get this through an IV? I don't want to be, poked four times. And I was like, no. So oddly, it's definitely not a walk in the park and it's a lot, but I think that it becomes easier in certain populations because IVs hurt.
Yes, needles in general. It doesn't matter what they're going into. Okay, so prevention, I think we've covered. How about treatment? Monica, any updates on, I know there's been some new publications as far as efficacy of some of the treatments. Anything to share?
Yeah. So I think the two biggest ones have to do with nirmatrelvir, ritonavir, your favorite drug to pronounce. Although I guess we have new drugs that you can stumble over the pronunciation. So finally, we have the EPIC-SR trial published. If you recall back to our very first mid-year presentation, I had a slide about EPIC-SR, and the SR stands for standard risk. So these were patients that didn't have risk factors for severe disease, or there were patients that did have risk factors for severe disease, but they did receive some vaccines. So we were kind of excited about that, particularly in the immunocompromised population, because they were like, oh, great, this might be our patient population. Patients have high risk for progression to severe disease. They did get vaccines. We're going to see if this drug works in that vaccinated population. So after many delays, the study was finally published in peer-reviewed publication. The primary outcome is different than what we looked at EPIC-HR. The HR was high risk. In HR, we looked at hospitalization or deaths. But in SR, we were looking at the time difference to symptom alleviation, which if you notice a lot of the current studies, that's more what we're looking for. Many of our patients aren't being hospitalized. Thankfully, death is not really an occurrence that we're seeing too frequently just because the majority of the population has immunity either from previous vaccine or previous infection and the changing of the variant. So I think the endpoint was appropriate here. Digging down into the patients that were included, about 1,200, 1,300 patients, about half of them, so 600 or so, had this one risk factor plus a previous vaccine. Unfortunately, the high risks that were seen were obesity, smoking, hypertension, diabetes, and older age. So it's not really the, severe immunocompromised that we've been talking about in this entire series about our transplant patients or our chemo patients or on immunosuppressants. Additionally, there was no difference seen in the primary endpoint for the nirmatrelvir ritonavir group, about 12 days for symptom alleviation, about 13 days for placebo. That was not significant. Additionally, they looked at rebound information. So viral rebound, about 4.5-ish percent of patients that got the active drug versus about 4.1% of placebo patients, which is higher than we've seen, in the original studies. Symptom rebound was even higher, 11.4% nirmatrelvir ritonavir, 16.1% placebo. So we know that rebound is a thing. Whether or not treatment alleviates or prevents rebound, data don't really support that too much. Dysgeusia, so taste disturbance, that's going to be a big thing that our patients have been complaining about and continue to complain about, seen in about 6% of patients here. The one thing that I want people to pay attention when they're reading this is what the definition of viral rebound was. So in this study, they looked at a viral threshold of 3 log 10. I don't know if there is a correlation between what the viral level is and whether we can transmit it to other patients or whether we have active disease again. So these viral threshold counts, thresholds, vary from trial to trial. For in this one, in EPIC-SR, it was 3 log 10. Moving on, the other one, so what the drug company is calling EPIC-IC, so the IC stands for immunocompromised. The results were presented in poster format at CROI. So we have a poster. We don't have peer-reviewed publication with the supplement and the appendix that we all love to dive into. But this also was presented very briefly at one of our first presentations. This is the study that was looking at patients who were immunocompromised and who received either 5 days, 10 days, or 15 days of nirmatrelvir ritonavir, about 50 patients in each. And this was hopefully going to tackle the issue of, are our immunocompromised patients, should we be treating them for longer? Is that going to help with overall outcomes? Is that also going to help with some of this rebound? So all the patients that were included, immunocompromised, the vast majority was medication related immunocompromise. But they did have a definition of severe immunocompromise that included patients that have received CAR T cell therapies, B cell depleting therapies, hematopoietic stem cell transplantation, or heme malignancies. Small component of patients, but I think this definition of severe immunocompromise is going to be important to come back to. Their primary endpoint was looking at a viral load lower than the lower limit of quantification at days 15 to 44. Their lower limit of quantification was defined as 2 log 10. Additionally, a secondary outcome that they were looking at was rebound. And their definition of rebound was an increase of 0.5 log 10 compared to the end of therapy, with an overall viral load of greater than 2.5 log 10. So again, if you compare that to what they said rebound was in EPIC-SR, EPIC-SR was 3 log 10, EPIC-IC is 2.5 log 10. So the primary endpoint, again, looking at whether the viral load fell below 2 log 10, across the board, there didn't seem to be any difference. About 61 to 71% of the patients had decrease this fall of viral load, regardless of if it was a 5 or a 10 or a 15 day therapy. When they did break it down by immunocompromised severity, this is where potentially we start seeing some difference. For the patients that were non-severely immunocompromised, it looks like 5 days of therapy was just fine. 5 versus 10 versus 15, it doesn't look like there's any difference. Again, we're talking low numbers. Looking at the severe immunocompromised, though, it did seem that we had a more complete decline to that viral threshold in the patients that got either 10 or 15 days of therapy. And definitely around that 10 days or longer is when we start seeing those viral loads be undetectable. So maybe for our severely immunocompromised patients, again, that was CAR T cell depletion, B cell depletion, hematopoietic stem cell transplant, or heme malignancies, maybe 10 days or longer is more beneficial. Additionally, I do want to say some caveats. When the study was done, the vast majority of patients had not received a vaccine in the 6 months prior. So it wasn't that quote unquote booster that we are recommending now. If patients are up to date and have received a booster vaccine, will this 10 or 15 days and the severely immunocompromised have the same effects? We don't know. Additionally, those that were randomized to the longer therapy, to the 10 or 15 day therapy, it seemed that they had higher baseline viral loads to begin with. Does that factor into why they did not decline as quickly? And then rebound, again, not powered to really detect this, but some trends were seen. It seems that there were more rebounds in the 5 days of therapy, 25% in the severe group versus 12.5% in the non-severe. 10 days, it was 0% rebound in the severe group versus 3.2% in the non-severe. And for those who were randomized to 15 days of therapy, 5% rebound in the severe, 0% in the non-severe. Numbers are kind of all over the place. They are low numbers. I don't necessarily know if we can make much of the rebound data. But again, poster only presented last month, waiting publication. I think when we have more data, we can look at the different sub-analyses and take away more information. Again, we have to talk about now that this product is commercially available, clinicians can use this quote unquote off-label. However, will insurances pay for that longer therapy? I think still needs, is going to be determined to be seen, even with the additional coverage and payment that is available through the manufacturer. There are certain allowances, time periods, dollar amounts that they will cover.
Thanks, Monica. That was a lot. We appreciate you taking us through all of that. We haven't heard much about molnupiravir in a while. Anything that you'd like to share?
I struggle with molnupiravir. I still don't know where its place in therapy is. I think it's, you know, if you can't get your ritonavir because of drug interactions, or the patient refuses to take it because of dysgeusia or other reasons, you can't get the patient in for a remdesivir infusion, then you can consider molnupiravir. It's a lot of pills. You know, it's still a lot of pill burden. I do not know of any reformulation with lower pill burden. There was talk about maybe one time this coming to fruition. And then there are reports of resistance developing, you know, mutations happening. So longevity of that product compared to the others might not be as long. But again, not as great data compared to everything else.
I think these are really complex. You know, some of these populations are specific, especially in the groups we're mostly interested in, immune compromised. So thanks for talking us through that. And then I'll open it up to the group in general on anything you're seeing on clinical trials or in the pipeline that we should be expecting in the next, I'd say, few months.
Well, from the PrEP perspective, there are other monoclonal antibodies coming out soon. So AstraZeneca does have a new sort of Evusheld or tixagevimab, so Gavimab 2.0, that it's hopefully going to make it through FDA authorization within the next few months. So that's another one to look for and possibly give us more options. You know, with these variants, it's always a game of catch up, right? So with this JN.1, it's always catch up. So whatever we can add to the toolkit is always going to be a good idea. And if we have options, that's always good. More options is always better than none. So hopefully we'll have that to look forward to within the next few months from a pre-exposure perspective.
So the only thing I have to add, not really about in the pipeline, but as far as utilizing nomotrevavir and ritonavir, I see you're going to tear me apart from my pronunciation. I have a Southern accent. But as far as utilizing this in children, the Paxlovid mouth is catastrophic to be able to convince patients to utilize this when they're adolescents. They just won't do it. And there was a publication in 2023 that everybody always assumed it was ritonavir. It's ritonavir that's causing that. And yes, it is ritonavir. That's a portion of it. But what studies have actually found is that the nirmatrelvir actually potentiates one of the receptors in the mouth, TAS2R. That's one of the bitter taste receptors itself. And as far as like utilizing saccharin, which can be used for ritonavir to alleviate some of the taste, it actually doesn't work on this at all. So this was really an interesting finding to try to hopefully stimulate research in the future for ways to kind of mitigate this Paxlovid mouth that's really hindering the adherence and the use of this drug. So hopefully more will come out of that in the future.
If our listeners have not caught our office hours that we posted two months ago, I covered a lot of the upcoming therapies as well. So I will just refer them to that to be brief.
Well, I think that probably concludes our podcast. I'd like to thank everyone today for weaponizing drug pronunciations against each other. So, but we did some interesting information out there, you know, on vaccines, obviously a new pre-exposure prophylaxis medication, some new evidence, clinical trial data on oral treatment. So fair amount to catch up on. So we thank you for joining us today. That's all the time we have. I do want to thank our guests again. It's always a pleasure. So thank you, Kathy, Monica, and Sarah for joining today. And we hope you've enjoyed today's conversation. Be sure to subscribe to ASHP Podcasts through your favorite podcast provider, and we'll hear from you next time. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks for joining us for the ASHP Advantage Podcast, Engaging the Experts. Be sure to visit ashp.org/podcast to discover more great episodes, access show notes, and download the episode transcript. If you loved the episode and want to hear more, be sure to subscribe, rate, or leave a review. Join us next time for more expert perspectives on ASHP Official.